The headlines: Iran rebukes the U.S. for its attempt to remove the Islamic Republic from the U.N. Commission on the Status of Women. Britain is bracing for more disruptive strike action as the rail and maritime unions reject an offer from operators. And Moscow says a price cap on Russian oil exports will not affect its military campaign in Ukraine. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Tehran condemns the U.S. attempt to remove Iran from the U.N. Commission on the Status of Women, calling it illegitimate. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says Washington is trying to block independent states' rights to a free vote in international bodies. Kanani says Iran earned membership in its commission after a recent voting session by the U.N. Economic and Social Council. The spokesman says the U.S. move questions the legality of such mechanisms in international bodies. The U.S. is pushing a draft resolution at the Council to remove Iran from the U.N. Commission on the Status of Women. The country has just started a four-year term on the body. Tehran has repeatedly warned that some Western countries are exploiting human rights for their own political means. Journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas joined us earlier for comment. He said the U.S. uses human rights as an excuse to invade countries and incite a so-called color revolutions.
So this is, it has no real basis because America has long used human rights as a beating stick, as an excuse to go and invade countries, to create color revolutions, to do regime change. And this is no different. I mean, using particularly the notion of human rights for women is an old, very Islamophobic trope. It's an Iranophobic trope, because what it implies and what it hints by trying to block Iran from having its rightful democratic say is that these people are actually not part of our garden, as it were. They're part of the jungle. These are the barbarians. And I think it's a hugely insulting move by the Americans, but then they're at a desperation point where they're hypocritically accusing Iran of anything and everything under the sun in order to get it to come to heel over all sorts of issues, like, of course, the JCPOA nuclear deal, in terms of also being more subservient in all ways to the World Bank and all the other kind of the money mafia that exists out there. But if America and anybody wants to look neutrally at America's execution of human rights in its own shores, well, you'd see the hypocrisy there quite openly.
Israeli forces kill yet another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says a 23-year-old Omar Mana was shot at the Edeshina refugee camp near Bethlehem this morning. He was reportedly hit in the chest by live fire. Six others were also injured by Israeli fire. Hamas resistance movement slammed the Israeli regime over extrajudicial killing of the young man, promising that the Palestinian people will stand steadfast in the face of Israeli aggression. Meanwhile, Palestinian factions in Bethlehem have declared a general strike and a day of mourning. Israeli forces have been killing Palestinians in the occupied West Bank almost on a daily basis. The regime forces have killed more than 200 Palestinians in the Palestinian territories so far this year. We earlier asked our West Bank correspondent Mona Kandel about the details of the latest Israeli raid.
Israeli forces raided the Tehesha refugee camp in Bethlehem to conduct an arrest campaign. This is according to a statement issued by the Israeli military. The Israeli soldiers stormed a number of houses in Adhesha refugee camp. Of course, Palestinians have resisted the incursion or the raid of the Israeli forces to Adhesha refugee camp. Clashes took place between Palestinian youths and Israeli forces. As you have mentioned, 23-year-old Omar Manna was shot and killed during this operation. Six others were wounded as well. And the Israeli forces arrested three Palestinians. Two of them are brothers. The Israeli military accuses those Palestinians who were detained in a Dahesh refugee camp that they are engaged in a number of anti-Israeli activities. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, another raid was have taken place to Jenin area. This time, the Israeli forces unfortunately succeeded to arrest Palestinian activist and fighter. He is the son of Bassam Assadi, the senior leader of the jihad movement, and he's also a Palestinian prisoner in Israeli jails. The Israeli forces said the main aim to Jenin incursion is to arrest the son of Bassam Assadi, the senior official of the jihad movement in northern occupied West Bank.
Britain's Rail and Maritime Union rejects the 4% pay rise proposed by train operators to end the highly disruptive strike action by rail workers. The RMT union says the offer does not meet its criteria for securing long-term job security for its members. Last week, the union said more than 40,000 workers would stay strikes in December and January, signaling major Christmas disruptions. The union also organized major industrial actions that caused massive disruption in the summer. Britain has witnessed a series of walkouts across different sectors over the last months. The government is now considering using military help to fill in for striking workers ahead of key walkouts by nurses and ambulance staff. Our correspondent in London, Robert Carter, joined us earlier with more details on rail and maritime strikes in the UK.
Negotiations are happening behind the scenes, and there are, of course, many issues, not just pay, that are being discussed here. Things including, like, how long a pay increase can be implemented, because sometimes it can be over a number of years. So things like that, there's a lot of details to get through. I think what's most important to mention is that these talks have ultimately failed so far, and that there is serious strike action being planned throughout the month December, with future strikes also on the horizon in January as well, just after the new year. So absolute chaos is expected to take place if these talks don't actually make any progress at all. And it's not just rail unions that are preparing strikes for this month alone. There are also NHS and ambulance driving unions which are planning strikes on certain days in the midweek of December. There's also a major postal strike action which is being planned again in the lead up to Christmas. It's an important time of the year here for the British economy as packages, parcels, businesses are in full swing. And of course, all of these key sectors are basically shutting down their operations, which are going to absolutely cripple momentum during this Christmas month at a time when Britain's economy is trying to bounce back and to get itself moving again.
Britain's Labour Party has vowed to abolish the upper chamber of Parliament, or the House of Lords, as part of a constitutional revamp if it wins the 2025 general elections.
Labour will rebuild trust by reforming the centre of government, cleaning up sleaze, nourishing the relationship between central government and the devolved authorities, and replacing the unelected House of Lords with a new, smaller, democratically elected second chamber.
Starmer called the House of Lords, quote, indefensible. He said the move will be the biggest transfer of power from Westminster to the British people. The blueprint for reform was drafted by former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, but the latest pledge comes as the country is suffering from economic turmoil and a cost of living crisis. The draft is yet to be discussed, and if agreed upon, it will be incorporated in the party's election manifesto. The House of Lords includes a mixture of political appointees and hereditary peers, as well as senior bishops. And a price cap on Russian oil exports announced by the European Union and the Group of Seven developed countries has come into effect. The Western move is aimed at limiting Moscow's ability to finance its war in Ukraine. The European Union has also banned all imports of seaborne crude from Russia, apart from placing $60 price caps on Russian oil. The measure, jointly taken by the EU and the G7, means third-party countries cannot use Western tankers, insurance firms, and credit institutions if the cargo is sold at a price higher than the designated ceiling. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says the price cap will roil global energy markets further, but will not affect Russia's ability to fund its military operations in Ukraine. Peskov says Moscow is preparing how it would respond to the move. Russia has said that it will not sell its oil to countries that apply the price cap. We earlier discussed that the latest Western measures against Russia and its energy sector in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
News Review regular deeper into some of the top stories of the day. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Jerome Hughes, who's joining us from Brussels. Also, we have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich joining us from Belgrade. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Jerome in Brussels. Walk us through all the details that we need to know about this EU and G7 imposed price cap on Russian oil.
That's right, Bardia. Well, this is sort of the latest pressure from the West, so to speak, to try and apply more pressure on Russia. And as you mentioned in the introduction, Russia has said that, you know, it won't recognize this cap, and it's even willing, it says, to reduce production if necessary. Well, you've heard from Vladimir Zelensky as well, the Ukrainian president, who says that this has shown weakness from the West because they wanted, or he wanted, Ukraine wanted a cap of, at least $30 per barrel of oil, or actually just a complete ban on Russian oil altogether. That's what they would have wanted. Because actually, if you listen to what the industry experts are saying, that, you know, before the war in Ukraine, Russia was typically selling its oil for around typically between $55 and $65 dollars per barrel of oil. So, you know, this cap of $60, it doesn't seem to be maybe having the desired effect, especially when you have a case. I mean, you mentioned about the G7 countries and the EU countries. Those tankers won't be able to go above this cap. But actually, Russia itself has plenty of its own tankers. And you already have the likes of China, which has said that it is happy to go with the status quo with its current arrangements with Russia in terms of its energy supplies. And of course, China is a major customer, it's a major consumer of oil. So actually, you know, the EU and the G7 countries are saying this is designed to try and stop Russia's war machine. Well, actually, you know, in terms of what we've seen so far with all of these energy restrictions that they've tried to impose on Russia, well, actually, one of the main beneficiaries so far has been the United States, because it produces plenty of its own gas and oil. So it's been able to sell gas, for example, liquefied natural gas, to the EU at huge prices. So actually, it's doing very well. But the bloc that's really struggling are the 27 countries of the EU that are really struggling to find energy at a reasonable price.
Mr. Bosnich, give us your thoughts on this recent price cap. Russia has already said that it won't abide by it.
Well, obviously not. Oil is one of those commodities that literally flows in the direction of the markets which are willing to pay for it. And if the European Union is going to put another nail in their own economic coffin, they can do so. Because what they are going to do, in effect, is to make sure that they will not be receiving any Russian oil that they had hoped to receive. And so their own efforts to punish Russia will once again boomerang on the EU, thereby accelerating and worsening the crisis that they're already facing. You couldn't have made a worse decision. That's the best way to describe what the EU is now.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Jerome Hughes, our correspondent, joining us from Brussels, and thanks to journalist John Bosnitz joining us from Belgrade. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review, but do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come.
Sudan's military and civilian leaders have signed an initial deal aimed at ending the political crisis in the country. The deal provides for a two-year civilian-led transition towards elections. It was signed by Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and by multiple civilian groups, including the Forces for Freedom and Change. That is the main civilian faction that was ousted in last year's coup, which triggered the unrest in the African country. The coup led to more than a year of mass protests against the military. Over 120 people are said to have been killed in the ensuing protests. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Economic divide.
It's a concept that has been around for a while, and you probably take it into account when you buy a product by looking for the label, for example, or the color. It's called greenwashing. What is it? Well, that's what we're here to tell you. For even though companies are supposed to comply with green energy commitments, which they use to advertise their products, they're guilty of lying about it. Some of the headlines coming up in this program. First, greenwashing as a whole. What is it? Well, in one sense, marketing as environmentally friendly, but it's also said to be a ploy to make more profits. In essence, a deceitful marketing gimmick is how some describe it. Next up, we will take a look at something that happened recently by the name of the COP27 climate conference. Banks and corporations are said to be lying about their commitments, pledges of net zero emissions, for example, again being false. Then the big question of accountability. Does the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, actually have a game plan? And then greenwashing reality. That's right, scamming the hopelessly naive. Governments are also guilty of this, scamming taxpayers under the guise of going green.
As the world continues to suffer from a climate crisis in all corners of the globe, concerns are rising over what critics have called greenwashing. The concept refers to a practice through which false information or misleading impression is conveyed about the environment friendliness of a company's products. Greenwashing involves making an unsubstantiated claim to deceive consumers into believing that a company's products are environmentally friendly. The concern was recently raised by the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres during the climate change conference in Egypt.
And today's crisis cannot be an excuse for backsliding or greenwashing. If anything, they are a reason for greater urgency, stronger action, and effective accountability.
Experts believe actors cannot claim to be net zero and at the same time continue to invest in new fossil fuel supply or any kind of environmentally destructive activities. They also cannot claim to be net zero while they are lobbying activities against climate change or just report on one part of their business's assets while hiding the rest. The practice is even more dangerous at state levels. Recently, it was announced that over $340 billion per year by 2030 is needed to prevent Earth's temperature from increasing by 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. For governments and their affiliated businesses, the large amount of money is viewed as a potential source to tap into, while at the same time, they portray themselves as environmentally friendly actors.
When it comes to social media posts, many of the items that we looked at concerned climate change. Of course, greenwashing was mixed in with some of the online media posts, but it's incredible how people feel about this in terms of the focus being that there's not enough being done to actually enforce it. And in other words, for companies to actually comply with the commitment, especially when it comes to the labeling of the packages that is being sold to consumers. All right, first up, this is our first post. The downgrades of ESG funds come as the environmental, social, and governance sector faces growing criticism and accusations of greenwashing, which have prompted investigations by regulators and law enforcement in the U.S. and in Germany. Now, we want to step further, take a look at this and see what it has to say. It said European asset managers are blaming regulatory confusion, the keyword confusion, for downgrade of ESG funds, where Europe's top asset managers are downgrading their ESG funds holdings, in which it's comprised of tens of billions of dollars of client money that had been badged at the highest level of sustainability, but which have come under increasing regulatory scrutiny. The downgrades come as the environmental, social, and governance sector faces growing criticism and accusations of greenwashing, what we just said, and of course that has prompted investigations by regulators and law enforcement in the U.S. and Germany. Have to wait and see what pans out or what comes out of those investigations. Next post, we don't get much water out here. This particular post we took a look because it was interesting in terms of climate crisis as a whole. This says we don't get much water out here. They're going to pollute it. Duranda Shoshone tribe making that claim. 1.7 billion gallons of water depletion per year is planned at the Thacker Pass lithium mine. Next up, just like fossil fuel lobbyists, animal agriculture lobbyists were also present at the COP27 energy that happened that also involved greenwashing, the effects of the meat dairy on the planet. Science is very clear. We need to end animal agriculture and shift to a plant-based food system in order to mitigate the climate crisis. All right, those were some of the posts. Sorry, we picked a couple over there where it kind of swayed a little bit away from greenwashing, but still was under the umbrella of the climate crisis. Let me introduce our guest for this segment of the Q&A. Joining us first is Julia Giordano. She is the ECCO head of international programs. ECCO is an Italian climate change think tank based in Italy. Julia Giordano, welcome to Economic Divide. Please explain to us first what greenwashing actually is. From what we understand is when an organization spends more time and money basically on marketing itself as being quote unquote environmentally friendly than actually minimizing its environmental impact. I mean, it sounds like a deceitful gimmick. What are the gains for companies by doing this? And why not just actually go and do it, be environmentally friendly?
Okay, so, yeah, first of all, your definition is pretty much correct. I would say is the attempt to present a product or a strategy as environmentally friendly when it in reality is not. And it's done through, as you said, marketing and communication strategies, but can also be done through other tools, other mechanisms, shortcuts, for example, to present a product, to present something as green, as environmentally friendly, when it's not. The reason is to preserve the status quo, to protect profits, in the kind of like assumption that moving forward towards a more sustainable economy would not be beneficial, which is a big mistake. The reality is that the transition towards, for example, a fossil fuel economy could present enormous opportunities for a sustainable, just, and greater development for many countries.
All right, Joellen Lewis-Russell is an American oceanographer and climate scientist who joins us now. Joellen Russell, welcome. Are there enough laws out there to actually enforce these green commitments, or for companies to adhere to these claims that they use, that there's green energy in their production process, do you think?
The more the better. But I also worry a little bit that we're putting a lot of emphasis on what we call adaptation, basically just getting used to being able to handle the very high heat, the very large floods, the coastal inundation, you know, our incredible droughts out here in the West, and the wildfires and the emissions. But it would be, as a scientist, I'm more interested, because I am robot floats and measuring how much carbon's going into the ocean, et cetera. I'm more interested in mitigation.
It's time now for the InfoNews section of the program, where we take a look at economic news from around the world. First up, we're going to take a look at Germany and how it's doing overall. It's obviously experiencing lots of problems, and it's affecting living standards. The country's living standards, according to this piece of news, could collapse. This actually was something that a government politician said, that the EU's biggest economy could soon become CO2 neutral, but poor. That's according to a politician by the name of Henning Hohne. He said people need to realize the seriousness of the situation, noting that a number of companies, from Lanxess to BASF, are ready to invest anywhere but Germany. Of course, that has to deal with the rising energy costs in that country. Next up, let's take a look at cryptocurrencies and see how they're doing. Well, crypto collapse is continuing. This headline read, Betrayed, FTX meltdown signals end to crypto's Wild West days. Cryptocurrency exchange's spectacular collapse has spurred government scrutiny and has called for greater regulation. Now, just to put things in perspective, crypto peaked in November 2021. At that point, investors lost more than $2 trillion up to this point. That's $2 trillion with a T. Okay? All right. This particular topic is very interesting. It's about meatless products. And it says that maybe times are ending for the meatless movement. Beyond Meat, which is a company that produces this, is struggling, and the plant-based meat industry is worrying. A few years ago, business was booming. That growth has slowed, with some wondering if the number of consumers has reached its limit. Now, the debate is whether Beyond Meat's struggles are specific to the company, or is it a harbinger of deeper issues in the plant-based meat industry overall. Next up, let's take a look at gold, in particular, China's gold reserves. China has secretly been hoarding gold. Central banks across the world have actually stepped up their gold purchases after Russia's overseas assets were frozen under sanctions this year. Now, the gold-buying frenzy comes as part of fresh attempts by central banks who want to protect their assets by reducing their exposure to the U.S. dollar. And finally, since we're in the World Cup fever, this particular piece of news caught our attention. It's about FIFA and its earnings. FIFA World Cup revenue was up by more than $1 billion. That's right, after taking the tournament to Qatar. Now, the sponsorship was boosted by deals with Qatari companies. Costs were reduced by effectively holding World Cup in one city. So that's the key. Then the earnings from this World Cup cycle are, as a result, $1 billion more than those generated from the 2018 tournament that was held in Russia.
You're listening to Economic Divide. This series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The in-depth section is upon us. Being an ecologically conscious consumer, or green consumer in short, is tough. It feels like there is an endless list of brands that we actually need to avoid. in order to identify misleading ads, the following we have termed the six sins of greenwashing. All right, first one is called hidden trade-offs. Perhaps the most famous example of this category is organic farming. Organic food is marketed as better for the environment because it eliminates the use of synthetic items, things like pesticides or fertilizers or antibiotics. But the manufacturing process, well, that emits carbon dioxide. That is why it's called the hidden trade-off. Sin number two is called no proof. What does that mean? Well, environmental claims need to be backed by certification and science. Businesses can't claim the products are, quote, emissions-free or all-natural without the proof. Many companies are reluctant to publicize their manufacturing process, but when they are making definitive environmental claims, they need to show their work. That's what that means. On to sin number three. This one is pretty obvious about what it means, vagueness, and those are some of the labels there. Terms like green or environmentally friendly or sustainable don't really mean anything. While they imply some environmental benefits, there's no strict standard for what they require. When companies advertise a green product but don't clarify what that means, it's a form of greenwashing. Sin number four, irrelevance. Some environmental claims may be true, but simply don't matter. For example, the sin of irrelevance is aimed at products that advertise an obvious environmental feature. One good example is what's called CFC-free products. CFC are the gases used for various purposes like in solvents or refrigerants or aerosol sprays. They have been banned for over 30 years, but you still see the products advertising that they are CFC-free. Sin number five, the lesser of two evils. Some product categories are just inherently hard on the environment. For example, an SUV may advertise as having 5% lower emissions. Yes, it is better than some alternatives, but that still doesn't make it environmentally friendly. The same goes for gasolines that make such claims. And finally, sin number six, fibbing or lying in short. Here, we're talking about just straight up lying. That's right, a company advertising its products are additive-free or contains no harmful chemicals, and it is simply not true. Relatively speaking, this form of greenwashing is fairly rare, according to stats, although that's hard to believe. Manufacturers are more likely to mislead rather than lie. You be the judge on that. Now, in terms of sins by category, let's take a look at the breakdown in terms of the percentages. The sin of hidden trade-off coming in at number one, followed by the sin of no proof at number two. The thing that is ironic is that the sin of fibbing or lying that I just mentioned is in last place. We ask, aren't all of these sins an act of lying? And finally, don't have to go very far to actually find out if the companies are lying. We went straight to the top to get information on that, to the company CEOs. And in a survey that was published of over 1,400 executives across different industries around the world, 58% of the CEOs admitted that their companies were guilty of greenwashing. Among the leaders in the U.S., that figure rose to 68%. Okay, let's bring back our guests to see what they think. Julia Giordano is ECCO head of international programs. ECCO, again, a reminder, is an Italian climate change think tank who rejoins us. Julia Giordano, welcome back. You are looking at the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres in the COP27 climate change summit or conference. What he said, banks and corporations making pledges of net zero emissions are taking the public for a ride. If everybody knows that, then why hasn't the UN as an organization acted on that or not worked with governments to implicate organizations who are guilty of this?
So this is actually what Guterres has been asking, and hopefully this is what it will happen. So last year, Guterres highlighted the risks of greenwashing, the risks that many entities can, as I said before, present something as green, as environmentally, as climate aligned, when it's not. So big corporations, financial institutions, and all kind of like non-state actors. So it called for the creation of a committee, of a group of experts, to analyze the situation and present recommendations to such actors on what should be done in order to be defined in line, aligned with the climate objectives. So we are talking about, you know, the alignment to the Paris objective of keeping global warming under 1.5, which is the limit, that if we go over, we have extremely catastrophic consequences for the planet.
All right, Joellen Lewis-Russell rejoins us, an American oceanographer and climate scientist. Joellen Russell, what is the story behind rich people actually admitting that they're or emitting more greenhouse gas emissions than people who are either underprivileged or poor? I mean, is that actually something that's true?
Preventing harm to well-served and rich communities as well as underserved communities. There's no way for a rich person to turn down the sun on super hot days so that their kids can play outdoors. You know, as well as not being able to go in for AC if you're in an underserved community or can't afford air conditioning. These are super important that we address both sides, adaptation and mitigation. And I am pro basically any policy that helps get us there, because like I mentioned, the carbon dioxide hangs out for an incredibly long time, long, long past when we will be here, and the harms are accelerated.
All right, that was Joellen Russell there. It's interesting though, when you think about it, that rich people actually emit more, I guess, CO2 in a sense, and then hence contribute to climate change in that respect. Oxfam came up with a real interesting study on that. Jody Grage rejoins us now. Jody Grage, a member of the Green Party over at the U.S. Jody Grage, welcome back. Greenwashing, just another way of scamming the hopelessly naive is how it's been described. And it's also been said that governments actually are very guilty of that, who have managed to basically relieve taxpayers of these countless of billions to fill slush funds, as it is said, under the guise of saving the world. Is this an accurate view on this, do you think?
Yes, I do. I don't know what it will take before corporations and governments realize that people are not, that we know it's not working. There may have to be a worldwide strike. I don't know. But obviously, reality itself is not enough to make corporations and governments do what they need to do. And part of the problem is that the poorest people with the fewest resources are the most affected.
It's been argued that greenwashing is just another way of scamming the hopelessly naive. For example, using a green pretext to protect U.S. economic interests, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden recently announced that it is launching Inflation Reduction Act. Biden's move is conveniently framed as a green energy initiative.
To a groundbreaking CHIPS and Science law that's going to ensure that technologies and jobs of the future are made here in America, And all this progress is part of our vision and plan and determined effort to get the job done for the American people.
It offers U.S. consumers tax incentives to buy American electric cars with batteries that have at least 40% of components from the U.S. or a country with which it has free trade. This is clearly an attempt by the U.S. administration to seize concerns about global climate crisis to protect the interests of U.S. businesses. But the move has triggered an angry response from the U.S.'s European allies, including France and Germany, who've accused Washington of using green strategy as a tool to protect its own interests. There are now calls within the EU saying that greenwashing of the protectionism scam is something that the EU state should be copying. It is now feared that it's only a matter of time before a Western government would use an environmentally pretext for self-serving economic reasons.
We have already explained to you what greenwashing is, but what we didn't tell you is that this is not a new phenomenon and has been going on for quite some time, even decades, especially in the US. During the 1960s, the contemporary environmental movement began to gain steam. The airwaves, newspapers, and magazines began to fill with newly greened corporate images. In the year 1969, public utilities spent more than $300 million US dollars on advertising. That was more than 8 times what they spent on the anti-pollution research they were tout in their ads. Then came the 80s and 90s, where greenwash ads increased and became more sophisticated. This was especially evident in the 1990 on the 20th anniversary of Earth Day. 1/4 of all new household products that came onto the market in the US around the time of Earth Day 20 advertised themselves as recyclable, biodegradable, ozone-friendly, or compostable. In the early 1990s, one poll found that 77% of Americans said that a corporation's environmental reputation affected what they bought. The 21st century saw big oil conglomerates capitalizing on the green agenda, which included names like BP and Shell. BP, the world's second largest oil company and one of the world's largest corporations, advertised its new identity as a leader in moving the world beyond petroleum. Yet, it has spent $5 billion over 5 years for oil exploration in Alaska alone. And finally, there are other forms of greenwash that carry the same misleading approach with the ultimate goal of attracting customers. Blue wash refers to corporations that wrap themselves in the blue flag of the United Nations in order to associate themselves with UN themes of human rights, labor rights, and environmental protection. And sweat wash, associated with child labor and sweatshop abuses, companies notorious for the use of sweatshops, used to divert attention from their factories' practices. Example include Nike, Reebok, and other major clothing and fashion brands, a practice which is continued till this day. That's the end of this part of the program.
This program covered a topic which companies have used to sell their products to environmentally friendly consumers or shoppers or buyers who care about the climate change. And that's really a good incentive. While many companies, not all, however, are guilty of not doing that, here's another thought. Green energy right now, when there's an energy shortage, do you think that it makes sense? It should. Don't get me wrong, but it's really just a myth. The world is facing an energy crisis like never before. I mean, electric cars? Who's got the money to pay for the electric bills? Meanwhile, our Earth, us, me and you, continue to gasp for clean air. That does for this edition of the program. Great, again, to have you with us. From Mikhail Tatwe and the entire team here at Economic Dubai, it's goodbye until the next program.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
هيهات مع ذلك الظن بك ولا المعروف من فضلك ولا مشبغ لما عملت به الموحدين من برك وإحسانك.
Dear listeners, we were discussing this excerpt of the Divine Kumail Supplication. ما ذلك الظن بك ولا المعروف من فضلك ولا مشبه لما عاملت به الموحدين من برك وإحسانك. Far be it from you, that is not what is expected of you, nor what is well known of your bounty. Nor is it similar to the goodness and kindness you have shown to those who profess your oneness. We said that none of the prophets and the imams and the favorite servants expected Allah to be treated with chastisement. This is because they were favorites, a holy prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, being one of them. Now, what is useful for us is knowing the fact that obedience to Ahlul Bayt makes us Allah's favorites. Anyone who wishes to be Allah's favorite must endeavor to purify himself, both internally and externally, by obeying him, by obeying his Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, and by obeying the Ahlul Bayt. In this relation, the Holy Quran says, قُلْ إِن كُنْتُمْ تُحِبُّونَ اللَّهِ فَاتَّبِعُونِي يُحْبِبِكُمُ اللَّهِ وَيَغْفِرْ لَكُمْ ذُنُوبَكُمْ. Say, if you love Allah, then follow me. Allah will love you and forgive you your faults, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the obedience to whom will make us Allah's favorites, has emphatically ordered his ummah to love Ahlul Bayt from the bottom of their hearts and to obey them under all circumstances in order to be Allah's favorite. He has said, أَحِبُّ اللَّهِ لِمَا يَغْدُوكُم مِّن نِعَمِهِ. Love Allah for the blessings he has bestowed on you. وَأَحِبُّونِي بِحُبِّ اللَّهِ. And love me because of your love for Allah. وَأَحِبُّ أَهْلَ بَيْتِي لِحُبِّي. And love my household because of your love for me. This is what the Holy Prophet has emphasized on.
And how can the gods of hell threaten him when he calls out to you, my Lord? And how would you abandon him therein when he has faith in your grace to set him free? Alas, that is not the concept of you, nor has your grace such a reputation, nor does it resemble that which you have awarded by your kindness and generosity. To those who believe in your unity, I definitely conclude that had you not ordained punishment for those who disbelieved in you, and had you not decreed your enemies to remain in hell, you would have made hell cool and peaceful, and there would never have been an abode or place for anyone in it.
Thank you, Allah,
God, that we're here,
feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God stays with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true. And we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So, dear listeners, anyone who wishes to live and to pass away like the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam must follow the household. Now, if one wishes to become Allah's favorite, he must follow the Ahlul Bayt, the head of whom is Allah's messenger. This adherence will lead man, of course gradually, to spiritual purification, to the extent of his capacity, of course. So, he will become Allah's favorite. To reach this station, it is only possible through Ahlul Bayt, because they are the straight path. They are the best guides and the followers of spiritual path. This Kumail's application that we have been discussing, that we have been talking over, is one of those words of the Ahlul Bayt by following of which we can reach salvation and become Almighty Allah's favorite. Now, the criterion for being Allah's favorite is being like the Ahlul Bayt, who have asked us to compare ourselves with them to see whether we are liked or disliked by Allah. فَإِنَّكُمْ وَسِيلَتِي إِلَى اللَّهِ وَبِحُبِّكُمْ وَبِقُرْبِكُمْ أَرْجُو نَجَاتًا مِّنَ اللَّهِ. This is what this application says. You, the Ahlul Bayt, are our means towards Allah. We set our hope on your station and love to be saved by Allah. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that the only thing that will bring heaven to us is having devotion in worshipping Allah and saying that there is no God but Allah. This is what this part of the supplication discusses. وَلَا مُشْبِهٌ لِمَا عَامَلْتَ بِهِ الْمُوَحِّدِينَ مِنْ بِرِّكَ وَإِحْسَانِكَ. This is not similar to the goodness and kindness you have shown to those who have professed to your oneness. The one who is devoted, I mean, the true meaning of devotion, is to act according to Allah's commandments, to abstain from committing sin, and to adhere to Ahlul Bayt. When the Holy Prophet ﷺ was asked about what devotion is and how it is related to there is no God but Allah, he answered, "It is to act to what I have been sent for and to love my Ahlul Bayt." They asked him whether love for Ahlul Bayt and acceptance of Imamah was part of this, and he said yes. The same matter is expressed by Imam Ridha alayhi salam in the hadith known as Silsilatul Dhahab, the golden chain. كَلِمَةُ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهِ حِسْنِي فَمَنْ دَخَلَ حِسْنِي أَمِنَ مِنْ عَذَابِ. There is no God but Allah, and this is my fortress. So whoever enters it will be immune from my punishment. Of course, there are conditions, and one condition is acceptance of my imam. So that is why the La ilaha illallah, monotheism, has been the first invitation principle of all the prophets. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.